This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Monday, January 27th. With the White House defense in day two of the 3 days that it gets, our guest on impeachment today is a constitutional law professor who believes Trump does not deserve removal from office. Maybe you saw the New York Times op-ed by Josh Blackman, professor at the South Texas College of Law. He's the author of books including An Introduction to Constitutional Law, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know. His op-ed is called Trump Acts Like a Politician, That's Not an Impeachable Offense. His Twitter feed, at Josh Blackman, includes both positive and critical reactions to the piece. It's an interesting read. Professor Blackman, we appreciate your time. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
First, you argue that impeachment is an emergency parachute to save the Republic from freefall, not just a parliamentary vote of no confidence. In theory or in practice for yourself, how do you recognize that line when you see it?
There's often an expression, would you rather send 10 guilty men to prison to save one innocent man, or would you rather let 10 guilty men go free to save one innocent man? I think presidential impeachments are very unique. We've had 45 presidents in more than two centuries, and we've only had two presidents who were impeached. I think we should be hesitant before we pull that ripcord and trigger the parachute, especially when we're only less than a year away from from the next election. There are grounds on which it's very clear that a president's been impeached, but I think when the standard is more vague and nebulous, I think a little bit more caution should be handled before you proceed with that process.
Were you in favor of either the Nixon resignation or the Clinton impeachment for historical context?
I was quite young when President Clinton was impeached. I don't think I had a contemporary opinion. In hindsight, I don't think it was a warranted effort, and I was not alive for the Nixon one, but I think his crimes were actually very well established. I think his resignation was far more justified.
What was it that Nixon did, in your opinion, that justified it?
He basically ordered his men with cash attached to it to lie to courts. And that's a very well-known offense of suborning perjury. I think that offense itself was not open to debate, and he should have been on notice that that was a criminal offense that warranted his removal from office.
You use two main examples in your op-ed as analogies to what Trump did with Ukraine, one from Lyndon Johnson and one from Abraham Lincoln. Can you describe the Lincoln one and make that case?
During the Civil War, people often forget we had a government that was running. We had elections that were being held, and Lincoln was not a popular politician throughout the country. The state of Indiana was holding elections in which the Republican Party was in some jeopardy of retaining power. Lincoln was worried that the Republicans would lose Indiana. So President Lincoln wrote a letter to General Sherman and said, please let the soldiers go home. They were Republicans, so they can vote. Basically, Lincoln was willing to take troops off of the front line to help the Republican Party in Indiana because he recognized the Republican Party would help carry the war through the end. He was commander in chief, and he made a life or death decision. And in doing so, he tried to help out his political party. Now, I think Lincoln was, justified. The stakes of the Civil War were quite high. And I'm not trying to disparage Lincoln's actions. My point is different. My point is that presidents routinely use their official power in ways that will perhaps directly or indirectly help themselves or their party's political future.
Although one could argue that it's not analogous and is maybe even offensive to compare Trump pressuring Ukraine to investigate the Bidens in exchange for releasing military aid, assuming that's what happened, a petty personal advantage just for his own power to toy with security aid for, to Lincoln's pursuit of what might be the noblest thing in presidential history, trying to preserve the Union and end slavery by winning the Civil War and trying to make sure that a competitor wasn't elected who would basically surrender to the South and let them secede. That's why he felt it was so important to take the risk, if it was as you described. Do you disagree with that distinction?
Oh, I hear it a lot. I got quite a bit of fan mail. I don't mean to compare Lincoln and Trump, and that's a very common remark I received. My point's different. The value of a presidential act is a matter of judgment. We elect presidents because of their vision and what they want to accomplish. Once the question comes down to how important is this national interest to us, that's a question which should be resolved at the ballot box and not for impeachment. There were some politicians at the time who did not think Lincoln's actions were justified, and some perhaps did. I think today there's some politicians who thought that Trump's actions were justified and some were not. If our entire debate is about whether this was justified or not, we're having a policy debate, not a question whether the president's violated the law. And that's why I use a Lincoln example to show people disagree on policy. Different politicians have different priorities. And if we're only looking at what those priorities are, we're not in impeachment land, we're in a political debate.
Want to make the LBJ analogy?
Sure. This one's a little bit more funny. President Lyndon Johnson wanted to put Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. Thurgood Marshall was the great civil rights icon who argued Brown versus Board and some other huge cases. Problem was there was no vacancy at the time. So what did Johnson do? He appointed Ramsey Clark as his attorney general. Who was Ramsey Clark's father? Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark. Basically, Lyndon Johnson appointed a Supreme Court justice's son to the attorney general position, knowing the father would retire because he would have so many recusals. He engineered a conflict of interest to put Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. And students of history will know this was a huge decision that helped solidify African-American support for Johnson as well as the Democratic Party in the 1960s. Again, engineering a conflict of interest on the Supreme Court is a very, very dubious move. But Johnson celebrated because he put the first African-American on the Supreme Court. I think he used his political power to help his party. And I think this was perhaps, I don't say it was justified, but I think in hindsight, people view it favorably.
Interesting story, and one that I did not know until I read your op-ed. And on that one, a critic could say power politics, yes, putting Justice Clark in a position that Johnson hoped would encourage him to resign. But again, not the same as the kind of extortion that Trump allegedly engaged in here. Your reaction to the analogousness in that respect?
Well, let's move on to extortion, or what might be called bribery. Usually with extortion or bribery, you're exchanging something of value, some sort of money or property. That is, the person making the threat gets some sort of money or value in return.
An investigation of the Bidens wouldn't be of value?
Well, what you have to remember here is the president has the authority to make that request. Merely receiving some sort of political benefit is not akin to receiving personal property or anything or any sort of money. That's not what extortion would be in any other context. We have cases where governors and other state officials ask for investigations, and the upshot of that is merely receiving a political benefit in the terms of scrutiny is not itself money or property. It doesn't fit into what bribery is. And Brian, I think it's notable that Democrats in Congress did not bring a bribery charge. They did not bring an extortion charge. I think the reason why they didn't bring a bribery charge is they couldn't make it. The quid pro quo we kept hearing about, the quid pro quo requires some sort of money or property value in return, not merely a political benefit. Instead, the Democrats brought this vague and nebulous abuse of power charge because they knew they'd have a harder time making the more specific case stick.
Why not consider, though, in political terms, since this is not a criminal case, as we all know, it is politics, it's subject to public opinion, etc. And even if the Democrats did not put bribery or extortion in the articles of impeachment, to consider that it is the moral act of extortion in that the thing of value, of tremendous value. I mean, he rode the investigation of Hillary Clinton, arguably all the way to the White House as one major component of his election victory, and with apparently no evidence that anyone's produced that Joe Biden has ever done anything corrupt in support of his son, he was apparently looking for a kind of phony investigation, and even the witnesses have testified, just the announcement of an investigation, so he had it to use. Wouldn't that be, considering the history and considering the, you know, apparent questionableness of what he was asking to be investigated, but even the value itself to his campaign, that it was more the moral equivalent of extortion for something clearly of great value to him?
Well, Brian, I think you posed the question perfectly. I am not going to defend Donald Trump's moral judgments. In fact, in my article, I actually criticize him. I say that there's really no reason to go investigate the Bidens, and we should have avoided it at all costs. But if the only question is one of morality, it's a judgment call. I think that's one the voters can decide the ballot box, and doesn't warrant the impeachment of an American president. Right? Once you strip aside all the legal niceties, we're discussing politics. We're discussing a policy decision. And lots of presidents have made terrible policy decisions that may have benefited them personally. And I don't think that's grounds to remove the president. That's grounds to maybe vote him out of office. It's grounds to perhaps not support legislation. It's grounds perhaps to conduct some sort of oversight. I think we should hesitate before using this this extreme measure of impeachment, which has only been used a handful of times in American history.
I guess the Democrats and other critics of Trump would look at the standard that you set in your op-ed. Impeachment is a parachute for a Republican for a republic in free fall, not a parliamentary vote of no confidence, which would remove a prime minister in a parliamentary system. On that standard of a Republican free fall, you know, Trump's critics see him as a thug who is a serial attacker of our democracy, from firing Comey to stop the Russia investigation and then boasting about it to the Russians and on TV, to threatening Marie Yovanovitch or saying about Colonel Vindman or the whistleblower that they're traitors, and you know what we used to do to traitors, to encouraging violence at his rallies under certain circumstances or praising the congressman who body slammed a reporter, remember that one, to his blanket refusal to abide by witness or document requests or subpoenas. That's the subject of Article 2. Does all of this and more, and you know people could layer on many, many more examples that they see as Trump leaning toward authoritarianism and kind of national moral turpitude, not add up to a picture so different from Lincoln or LBJ as to arguably be a threat to the republic?
Brian, again, I'm not here to defend Trump's morality, but what I would say, and I'll make this point very clearly, he's not a dictator, right? That's where that Nadler used the hearing a few days ago. I don't know that he's ignored any court orders. Generally, the actions he's taken are actions the president has, but as critics have said, he's acted with the improper motive, right? It's not that he's abusing power and that he's doing things he's not allowed to do. The president can fire the FBI director. The president can fire an ambassador. The president can request a foreign government launch an investigation. Those are powers he has. The criticism is that he's taking these actions with the improper motive. And I think, again, that's a value choice. Is he doing with the right heart? Is he doing with the right public spirit mentality? Does he have the right ethos, right? These are all very good policy debates which should be had at the ballot box, and I don't think they rise to the level of impeachment. Now, if Trump had ordered people to lie in court, if he started disobeying court orders, he had actually taken actions which are beyond the power of the presidency, I'd have a different opinion, which is why I think Nixon probably could have been removed from office for his turpitude, his actual acts of malfeasance. But Trump is again and again saying that he's acting within his powers most of the time, but he's doing with the wrong heart. He's doing with the wrong state of mind. And I don't think that is enough to proceed to conviction or removal.
We're getting a few calls of pushback. So, Patty, you're on the air with Professor Blackman. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to ask the professor this. If all Trump is doing is just act like a politician, then why would he not hand over documents to the House to prove his innocence or not call any witnesses to prove his innocence?
Professor.
I think your question's framed well. Why isn't the president trying to prove his innocence? In these sorts of proceedings, the burden isn't on the president. The burden is on the government, the House, to make their case. But the second part of the question, why isn't he responding to subpoenas? The refusal to respond to subpoenas has itself given rise to a second article of impeachment, what they've called obstruction of Congress. The president has argued that when the subpoenas were issued, the full House had not yet taken a vote on impeachment. Therefore, the impeachment subpoenas were void from the very beginning. I don't have a strong opinion on that, but there's a long-standing dispute between Congress and the president about the production of documents. It didn't begin with Donald Trump. There were debates from Obama and Bush about what sorts of subpoenas should be honored. Generally, the White House doesn't like giving their personal information about negotiations and the like. So I think this is part of a bigger conversation of the separation of powers that is not particularly linked to Trump. And by no means does he have the burden to defend himself. That's not his responsibility.
Let's take one more phone call. Hassan in Newark, Delaware. You're on with Professor Josh Blackman. Hello, Hassan.
Hello. Hi,
Hassan.
Yeah, thank you. I read your article in the New York Times. I was kind of really sad to read your article because I come from Africa, especially from Ivory Coast. I've seen people, prison using the political power to investigate a political opponent. And we know, like in Russia also, to speak of Russia, Putin always having to keep with the political opponent, having trouble with the Justice Department. If you say a president can investigate its political opponent using a foreign power, how America will be different from Russia or a dictatorship? There will be no difference. And how is that a policy to investigate a political opponent? That's not a policy to me. And third, I know if, let's say, Hillary Clinton's child or daughter kills somebody, the Justice Department will investigate her without Trump have to intervene. So how can you explain that to the people when America trying to be the beacon of democracy around the world, and you saying something like that as a professor of constitution is kind of, I mean, it's really disheartening. I'm really here for your turn.
Hassan, thank you very much. Professor, what would you like to respond to there?
Well, I appreciate the question. I think you stated the point very well. I don't think Trump is behaving the way he should. I think his actions consistently show poor judgment. And again, I'm not a fan of his, which is why I'm put in a tough position. The only question is who should decide if his judgment is poor. It should be decided by the ballot box. It can be denied a second term, or should it be done by the impeachment process? Right. If people want to vote against Trump because of his request to Ukraine, I think that's entirely rational. But I would just hesitate before using the sort of vague standard abuse of power, right? What's one person is abuse of power is another person's exercise of priorities and preferences. My argument isn't so much about Trump. My argument concerns the precedents being set for the future. And I worry that in the future, a Republican Congress might decide to impeach a Democratic president based on some sort of vague abuse of power without any concrete negotiations. I don't want impeachment to be this quadrennial feature of our republic. Every 4 years we impeach the president. We've had two impeachments in 200 years. I think that's a decent number. I think we should skew towards letting people decide the outcomes of these fates rather than allowing a majority of Congress to trigger this entire process.
Before we run out of time, let me ask you a couple of questions on the news of this week. The immediate question for the Senate in the coming days will be whether to call witnesses. Do you have a position supporting or opposing that?
You know, Brian, I don't have a strong position, to be frank. I think it would perhaps be helpful to have the witnesses, but I doubt there'll be any bombshells. I read this story this morning about the John Bolton book. I think it'll mostly confirm what people already know. So ultimately, if they're witnesses, the effect will be just to stretch this trial out. But I don't have a strong opinion on whether they should be testifying or not. It could be argued the House has a duty to collect all the evidence and the Senate tries it. But the House chose not to have witnesses, and I'm kind of on the fence with this question.
Let me drill down a little bit on the Bolton book. And for people who didn't see it, there's a New York Times story that dropped yesterday about John Bolton's forthcoming book. And it says President Trump told his national security advisor, Bolton, in August that he wanted to continue freezing $391 million in security assistance to Ukraine until officials there helped with investigations into Democrats, including the Bidens, according to an unpublished manuscript by the former advisor, John R. Bolton. So, and they hang it on multiple people. Multiple people described Mr. Bolton's account of the Ukraine affair to the Times. So assuming that's accurate, it would seem to put the last puzzle piece in place in proving that the president himself was directing the hold for a Biden investigation. This was one of the defense lawyers' arguments on Saturday, that they put it in Gordon Sondland's words, as he presumed the president was behind it, etc. But this would seem to be Bolton saying, yeah, the president himself was directing the hold for a Biden investigation. There's also Another piece of evidence, the report recently from JustSecurity.com that got the written message from Michael Duffy at the Office of Management and Budget on August 30th, when he wrote, clear direction from POTUS to continue the hold. POTUS, of course, is the president. So clear direction from POTUS to continue the hold, not Rudy Giuliani or someone without the president's full knowledge. I guess my question is, if true, how would that affect your view of the situation and that Bolton, with his firsthand knowledge, is saying this, either for calling Bolton rather than just let something like that come out later in the book, or regarding the impeachability itself, if true?
Well, let me make two points. First, I basically presume that's correct, right? My entire theory is based on the premise that Trump made the request to hold the money. I mean, I can pretend otherwise, but I think that's most likely outcome. Second, even if the witnesses don't testify, I think the senators can draw what's called an adverse inference. So a caller asked before about Trump, why does he produce evidence? He doesn't have to. But if Trump fails to produce evidence, I think a senator could look at the record and presume that Trump issued the order. I think that's a reasonable inference, right? This is not a strict jury trial where you have to have all the evidence in the record. I think senators can draw reasonable inferences. So I don't think that Bolton testifying or not would impact my theory in the least. I presume Trump made the order.
Josh Blackman, professor of constitutional law at the South Texas College of Law. He's the author of books including An Introduction to Constitutional Law, 100 Supreme Court Cases Everyone Should Know. We really appreciate you engaging in this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Starting on Wednesday, those 100 senators who've had to remain silent will get to ask questions of the lawyers from both sides, though only in writing. They'll be read by Chief Justice Roberts. We want to give you the chance, too. If you have a specific question about the case for either side, call it into the voicemail number I'm about to give you. All we ask is that you ask specific questions. Don't just make political attacks. If you'd like to pose a question about either side's case, we'll try to get you an answer. Call 844-745-TALK, 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK, and leave us a voicemail. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.